I'm not dying at any more any accelerated pace that any of the rest of us are, and I am just not running again.
Citing health concerns, Senator Bill Stoltz announces he will not seek re-election. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, hikers rescued from the Bear Glacier are grateful to be alive.
Nobody would have found us. Nobody would have even found the remains of us without being able to get our GPS coordinates out.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The Alaska House spent 6 hours debating oil and gas tax credits Tuesday night, and they're not done yet. Lawmakers are scheduled to pick up the bill again this evening. The debate revealed a deep divide among lawmakers over how to respond to low oil prices and the resulting state budget gap. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports, and Rachel Waldholtz brings us an update from the Senate.
The debate on the floor came down to this. Should the state expect oil companies to pay taxes, even when prices are so low they might be losing money? And how quickly can the state scale back its cash support for small oil and gas companies? For 6 hours, members of the Democratic minority offered amendment after amendment, but the divide wasn't solely along party lines. Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton broke with most of his caucus to propose more aggressively scaling back tax credits for oil production.
I think we need to look at what we're doing and the hole we're digging in the budget with these tax credits for not yielding any production, especially when there is basically zero production tax coming back. It's hard to have production tax credits when there's no production tax to offset it or ever retrieve that money back from.
Other Republican House members say the bill as it's currently drafted may go too far in taxing the oil industry. Big Lake Republican Mark Newman says imposing a hard tax floor of 2% violates the trust of an industry that the state relies upon for long-term investment.
We made commitments to industry. We should stand by those commitments, because if we can't, we're saying that we can't be trusted.
Lawmakers pointed out that the state is scheduled to pay out $775 million in tax credits this year, which is about the same size as proposed cuts to the permanent fund dividend. Juneau Democrat Sam Keto says it's unfair to ask education and social services to take cuts while oil and gas producers are spared.
At a time when we're telling municipalities that we can't maintain the revenue sharing program because we don't have enough money, at a time we're telling seniors we can't maintain the senior benefits program because we don't have enough money, we're saying, but we can't change things we're doing for the oil companies.
But Republican members note the industry has been laying off workers and has supported the state government for decades. And even if they pay no production taxes, oil companies continue to pay more than $1 billion to the state, mostly in royalties. North Pole Republican Tammy Wilson says it's short-sighted for the state to raise taxes on an industry she described as its bread and butter when it's already losing money.
Maybe we need to change our attitudes and be glad that they did invest here, and we are getting oil down the pipeline. Because I'm telling you guys, that line goes down, we're going to have real problems.
The bill's fate remained unclear heading into the second round of debate on Wednesday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
And I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage. Even as the House continues its marathon debate on the oil and gas tax credit bill, the Senate is moving its own version forward, hoping to beat the clock with just 4 days left in the session. The Senate bill is still a moving target. It was rushed through the Resources Committee this week. The Republican leadership released a new version Tuesday evening and passed it Wednesday, with Minority Democrat Bill Willikowski of Anchorage complaining on Twitter that he didn't even have time to draft amendments, adding, #bad process. But if Democrats like Willikowski are unhappy, that's nothing compared to how the oil and gas industry feels.
This is a nuclear bomb for Cook Inlet.
That's Kara Moriarty, president of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, speaking about a proposal to zero out all cash support for small companies in Cook Inlet as of 2018. To balance the cut, the bill would also set taxes at zero, collecting revenue only through royalties. Rebecca Logan, general manager of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, was even sharper.
You guys didn't do your job. On March 15th, when the budget came out of the Senate and was at $4.6 billion, I knew that we were going to get to a point where you were going to have to come to the oil industry because you didn't do your job on the budget. And so here we are. The policy call you're faced with right now is, are we going to put more taxes on an industry that is hemorrhaging?
The Senate bill doesn't include a hard minimum oil tax requested by the governor, and largely as a result, it would raise significantly less, under $100 million a year by the time it goes fully into effect in 2020, about a quarter of the governor's proposal. But the bill does include a controversial measure to end tax perks for new oil on the North Slope after 5 years. Those lower taxes are a key part of the current system. As the bill left the Senate Resources Committee, Chair Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican who is generally sympathetic to industry, said nobody is happy.
Nobody is winning right now. Nobody is winning with this bill. It's very difficult for me to offer this kind of legislation, knowing what it will do to this resource development. And I don't want to see those jobs lost.
The bill is now in the hands of the powerful Senate Finance Committee, the last stop before it goes to the full Senate. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Two skiers were whisked off a glacier on the southern Kenai Peninsula yesterday by an Alaska Air National Guard helicopter. Crews found the pair after they became stranded for 4 days. KBVI's Dish Eaton has more.
It's a trip that Jenny Nyman and Chris Hanna of Soldotna had wanted to take all winter, hiking and skiing on Harding Ice Field in Kenai Fjords National Park near Seward.
We are well aware that the weather on the Harding Ice Field is super dicey, so we've just been kind of keeping an eye on the forecast, looking for a completely clear, calm wind day with nothing coming anytime soon.
Nyman says they thought they'd found that day on Friday, although there was a weather system predicted to hit the area later that evening around 8 p.m., but they figured they could go up, ski for a few hours, and fly out long before then. So a friend with a plane dropped them off for a day of adventure late Friday morning.
We were skiing around. You know, we had 3 awesome hours up there. It was phenomenal. It was just beautiful. The snow was amazing. We were having a blast. And I kept thinking, man, this is the experience of a lifetime, being able to cross-country ski on the Harding Ice Field, looking out over the Kenai Fjords. I just didn't realize at the time that that lifetime was potentially going to get much shorter in the near future.
But around 2 o'clock, the weather changed quickly, says Nyman. At nearly 4,500 feet, she says, the glacier seemed to create its own weather.
These clouds just started materializing right behind the mountains, right on top of us. That weather just popped up literally out of blue sky within 15 minutes right over us.
They tried calling their pilot friend to come get them, but by the time they heard him overhead, the clouds had descended and he couldn't land. Then the snow and wind started. They grabbed their gear and decided to try to head on foot 20 miles to the north toward Exit Glacier and a road near Seward.
We only made it about 6 miles by 8 o'clock at night. The weather just kicked up so bad. We had like 10 feet visibility. It was snowing so hard. And the winds were probably blowing about 35, 40 at that point.
They had no choice but to hunker down in their tent and camp for the night. The weather was even worse in the morning. Nyman's companion, Chris Hanna, had a GPS satellite locator beacon and a cell phone. They let a friend know via text message that they were in trouble and asked him to let search and rescue know they may have to push their SOS button on the beacon. Late Saturday afternoon, he pushed that button, sending out his coordinates. That evening, their tent failed. They built a snow cave and got inside to wait and think about how they had gotten into such trouble.
We had nothing to do but stew about that. the entire time we're in there. It's not like we brought a deck of cards.
Alaska State Troopers handed the case over to the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. The 210th, 211th, and 212th National Guard Rescue Squadrons loaded onto an HH-60 Pave Hawk helicopter and an HC-130 King aircraft used for refueling. Rescue crews began communicating with Nyman and Hannah via text. Staff Sergeant Edward Egerton, spokesperson for the RCC, says the satellite locator beacon that Nyman and Hannah carried with them was crucial in helping rescue crews find the two.
They were able to communicate their situation to other people, and they were able to communicate their location. And so it gave us an idea of where to go, as opposed to having to wait for the weather to clear so that they can perform a search, which, you know, with the size of the area, could have added days to finding them, if at all. So in this case, it gave our people the ability to know exactly where they were going.
Bad weather and difficult terrain hampered rescue efforts for 3 days, but Monday night, four Alaska Air National Guard rescuers were delivered by helicopter onto the glacier. They camped overnight and located the two hikers just after noon Tuesday and flew them to a hospital in Soldotna. Nyman says the satellite locator beacon saved their lives.
That thing 100% saved their lives. We would not be here. Nobody would have found us. Nobody would have even found the remains of us without being able to get our GPS coordinates out.
Nyman says she and Hannah are both in good condition, and they are grateful to the rescue crews and the outpouring of care from the Kenai Peninsula community and people across the state. She says they're resting and recovering from the ordeal, and they're not planning any more glacier adventures anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't think either of us have any interest in ending up on the ice field anytime soon. My skis are now definitely put up for the season.
In Homer, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sitka grapples with landslide risk management.
You might have noticed that since the slide, the National Weather Service hasn't included landslide warnings in their weather reports.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Senator Bill Stoltz announced on the Senate floor today that he will not seek re-election. The Chugiak Republican cited health concerns, although he clarified that he was not dealing with an immediate health threat.
I'm not dying at any more any accelerated pace that any of the rest of us are, and I am just not running again. You guys have to bear with me through all the special sessions wherever they may meet.
Senator Stoltz is 54 years old. He has served in the legislature since his election to the House in 2003. He was elected to Senate District F in 2014 after state redistricting created a new Senate seat in South Central. Bethel City Council unanimously passed an ordinance last night to authorize reimbursements to Bethel property owners who the city overcharged on real estate taxes for more than a decade because of an error in the city's tax code. City Attorney Patty Burley discovered the problem and says the city overcharged about 160 transactions, collecting more than $100,000 in excess charges since 2002. The most the city could have overcharged someone, she says, is $1,200. Anyone overcharged will receive a refund with interest at 3.5%. People can start applying for refunds as soon as the city posts the claim forms on their website and makes them available at the city finance office. Proposals to make the state attorney general an elected position have appeared year after year in the Alaska legislature. This time, the measure is sponsored by Senator Bill Stoltz. It faces a high legislative hurdle, but it has moved through three committees and is pending in Senate rules. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, both sides, pro and con, say they want to keep politics out of the AG's office.
Stoltz says he wants the AG to be the people's attorney, not an appointee of the governor.
So whether it's to investigate criminal activity, to promote consumer protection, to give us independent judgments on on legal matters. So there, it doesn't just mirror what the political philosophy of the governor is, but with a somebody that has a constituency of the people.
Stoltz spoke at a finance committee hearing last week. Alaska is one of only seven states that don't elect their attorney general. The head of the Department of Law is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. Changing that would require amending the state constitution, which is what Stoltz is trying to do.
The attorney general would be able to, I think, have a greater independence, and I think it would become a very representative and innovative position for a conduit for the people of Alaska.
Often, proponents of letting voters select the AG say it makes the position less political. Former Attorney General Bruce Botello thinks the opposite.
There is an ongoing joke among attorneys general nationwide that AG actually stands for aspiring governor. And there is more than a grain of truth to that.
Botello says elected AGs often treat the job as a political stepping stone and sometimes see their governor as a political rival. Then he says a state may have to hire more attorneys as governors and various departments demand their own legal counsel. Also, Botello says an elected AG has to raise campaign money and may favor a particular industry or political base. Botello served as AG for governors of both parties. He says the Alaska Post tends to attract non-political types whose loyalty is to the law.
My own experience, both in that role, but also having worked for several attorneys general, has been that they have always retained their independent legal judgment. They provide the best advice they can.
As a proposed constitutional amendment, the measure would have to pass both the House and the Senate by a two-thirds vote to win a spot on the ballot. Liz Ruskin, APRN.
A bill to ban organizations like Planned Parenthood from teaching sex education in public schools failed in a House committee on Tuesday. Senate Bill 89, which would require parents to opt their kids in to sex ed lessons, was introduced by Senator Mike Dunleavy and narrowly passed House Education last month. On Tuesday afternoon, the Health and Social Services Committee, chaired by Representative Paul Seaton, heard more than 2 hours of heated public testimony on both sides before putting the measure to a vote. Vice Chair Representative Liz Vasquez, an Anchorage Republican, told the committee she supports the bill because she believes Planned Parenthood curriculum contains graphic material that many families would find offensive.
I'll be blunt. I'm a bit shocked by what I have found. I find that the materials are culturally insensitive. By that, I mean it is insulting, it is degrading to traditional cultures, their traditional Muslim cultures, their traditional Hispanic, Southeast Asian, and African cultures. This is very insulting.
Representative Garen Tarr opposed the bill, citing the need for comprehensive sexual education in a state with high rates of domestic violence and sexual assault.
It's time that these are issues that are talked about, that we remove the silence around these issues, and having these education materials in the school is a piece of that. It's been talked about today how the information can help. There's research that demonstrates without question that sexuality education works and that it actually can delay onset of sexual activity.
Tarr also noted that parents currently have the right to take their kids out of lessons if they wish. The bill failed in the committee 2-5, with Vice Chair Vasquez and Representative Talrico voting for it, and the rest of the members, including Committee Chair Seaton, against it. But Dunleavy, the bill's sponsor, is working on getting a bare-bones version of the bill added into a different education bill, House Bill 156. His amendment deals with parental permission, but does not specifically refer to abortion providers. That bill is scheduled to be heard tonight in the Senate Education Committee at 6:30.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Warm weather and early snowmelt are conducive to a mellow breakup. That was the message of forecasters during a teleconference yesterday. Alaska River Forecast Center senior hydrologist Crane Johnson anticipates more of a mush out.
Generally, we're trending towards thermal breakup on the Yukon, Kuskokwim, and other major interior rivers. We can expect breakup will likely be earlier than an average at most locations and possibly the earliest on record at some locations.
Warm spring weather allows ice to gradually rot, minimizing the chance of ice jam flooding, a scenario National Weather Service Climate Science and Service Manager Rick Toman says the records back up.
Years when we had significant, so moderate or major flooding on the Yukon River definitely has a cool tilt to the April and May temperatures.
Toman adds that current modeling indicates no sign of Alaska's warmer-than-normal trend changing over the next month.
The North American Multi-Model Ensemble has been consistent for months the spring in Alaska, showing this continuation of the very mild weather we've had since Christmas.
Toman and Johnson both emphasize the lack of snow cover over much of the state has exposed river ice to sun. The only Alaska River given a moderate to high chance of breakup flooding is the Sag River on the North Slope, where there's heavy ice buildup similar to last year when flooding damaged the Dalton Highway near Dead Horse. At their meeting last night, the Sitka Assembly broadened the city's commitment to landslide risk assessment. They approved a community-wide mapping project and an analysis of the Gary Paxton Industrial Park. And if their deliberations had a central question, it was this: given the land shortage in Sitka, does establishing risk zones hamper further development? Basically, how much is too much when it comes to landslide research? KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
It's hard to put into words just how much the August 18th landslides changed Sitkins and their relationship to the land. Take Assemblymember Matthew Hunter. The lifelong Sitkin mentioned how he accompanied Bill LaPrade, the geotechnical expert hired by the city, to survey the South Kramer Avenue area.
Hiking up around the landslide after the event, we got to talking, and the guy said, yeah, see all the flat area along the shorelines? That's all landslide deposit. So you wait long enough and something's going to fall, be it a tree or a rock or a hillside. And I guess it opened my eyes, opened all of our eyes to that risk.
But that risk is difficult to quantify. You can't tell the dangers of a slope just by looking at it, unless you're NASA.
The Jet Propulsion Lab of NASA flew their P-band radar system over the Sitka area twice to see if they could ascertain any further creep of our slide area.
That's Tori O'Connell, research director at the Sitka Sound Science Center. In the wake of the landslide, the center coordinated a geotask force to pool landslide research from NASA, the U.S. Forest Service, and a variety of other federal and state agencies. Presenting their findings to the assembly, O'Connell said that the rain event that caused the landslide, 3 inches in 6 hours, is rare, happening every 45 years. She added that the center is working with the National Weather Service to develop a better warning system for landslides.
You might have noticed that since this slide, the National Weather Service hasn't included landslide warnings in their weather reports on the marine weather. The hope is that with sighting of more weather stations, the modeling can make these warnings more specific.
With specificity in mind, the assembly also considered a resolution to develop a community-wide hazard map for Sitka. inspired by LaPrade's report from South Kramer, which mapped low, medium, and high-risk areas, this report would do a similar analysis along the entire road system. Shannon and Wilson, LaPrade's firm, estimated it would cost $150,000. Mayor Mim McConnell felt this was the more affordable option than going parcel by parcel.
There's people that maybe would want to know this but would not be able to afford to have a study done. I think that would not be very fair.
The pros of this kind of map are pretty obvious. It would enhance safety of people and property. But the cons are manifold, too. Here's Megan Bozak, Planning and Community Development Director, over the phone before the meeting.
Some of the cons could possibly be impact on property values and future sales of property, could be possible limitations on use of property or rights to property, and then certainly there could be limitations or impacts on development costs.
Assemblymember Stephen Eisenbeiss worried that in pursuing this information, the Assembly would one day order people to abandon their homes and would eliminate land for development altogether. Bozak assured him that regulations of any kind would come well after the mapping process, and Assemblymember Bob Petruski had this to say.
I've also had those same thoughts, Stephen, and it keeps coming back to me, though, if I don't know that I live in a risky area, I can't make that decision on my own, whether to stay there or not.
That comment steered the Assembly towards unanimous support of a community-wide hazard map on first and final reading. The Assembly's next item of business was to award a contract to Shannon and Wilson to perform a debris flow risk analysis at the Gary Paxton Industrial Park. Their administrative building, which was damaged by the August 18th landslide, is up for sale. City Administrator Mark Gorman said the city would not sell that or any other building at GPIP without a risk assessment first.
Our economy is struggling. We have an opportunity to start moving property again in the park, and it's not going to happen unless we do the risk mapping.
Eisenbeiss asked, who's telling us this is a must-do? City Attorney Robin Schmid chimed in, I am.
Trying to protect the assets of the city is my job, and we've got a building down there that was damaged by a landslide. It just wouldn't be prudent at all to turn around and sell it, have another slide hit it, we'd be looking at liability.
In the end, the Assembly voted to award the contract 5-2, with Eisenbeiss and Swanson opposed. With these proposals, the Assembly continues to build upon the hard lessons learned from the August 18th landslides. It seems their hope is that, even if the mountains come down, the city has done the work to protect property and people down below. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Dasha Eaton in Homer, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program, APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.